With that, the first case for oral argument this morning is Veith versus O'Brien et al. For Veith, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for Mr. O'Brien and the other defendants, we have Mr. Ed Evans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Mr. Evans. In Wheeldon versus Madison, this court said, "We agree that the right to know, to be informed, is a fundamental right personal to the patient and should not be subject to restriction by medical procedures that may be at odds with the patient's informational needs." The doctrine of informed consent is well established under South Dakota law, though informed consent cases are relatively rare, I think, because it seems almost unimaginable that a person could have a surgical procedure performed upon them that they did not ask for and did not want. But that is the allegation in this case. Because of his life-threatening weight, Darrell Veith was advised by his family doctor to have gastric bypass surgery. He researched his options, and he determined that the best procedure, the safest, the most common, and the one he wanted was something called a Roux-en-Y procedure. It's named after the French doctor who developed it. And so he went to Sioux Valley Clinic, and he requested and said, "I would like a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery." And they sent him to Dr. O'Brien, and he then told Dr. O'Brien that that was the surgery he wanted. And Darrell Veith went under the knife believing that he was receiving a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery. I don't think anyone disputes that the surgery itself went terribly wrong. There was a lacerated esophagus and an internal leak that was not diagnosed for, I believe, more than a month. And by the time it was diagnosed, it was so infected that it could not be treated. And Darrell Veith spent most of the next 2 years on feeding tubes and in and out of hospitals, and because of the damage, the leak, he was unable to consume calories to the point where his doctors described him as literally starving to death. And he was well over 6 feet tall. He went from a 350-pound man to less than 150 pounds. Finally, they were able to repair the leak about 2 years later, and he received a revision surgery, and after that is when he learned that he did not receive the Roux-en-Y surgery he believed that he requested and believed he was getting, but rather received a controversial procedure known as a mini-loop gastric bypass. It's known by some other names, that is not approved, not on the list of approved surgeries by the National Institute of Health, and it's not recommended by the American Bariatric Society, or at least it's not on their list of approved procedures, not in any medical text, and really only performed by a handful of physicians in North America, if that. And so in this case, we have both an informed consent claim and a negligence claim, medical negligence. Sometimes I don't become involved in a case really until post-trial proceedings. And when I got this case, and I was actually a little bit surprised to learn that there were so many legal issues and problems that I really believe are worthy of this court's inspection and review. And I won't be able to talk about all of them, but I believe all of them are important, and I'm ready, prepared to talk about any that the court wishes to. I'd like to go to the jury instructions first. The plaintiff in this case, we believe, was prejudiced by the submission of legally erroneous jury instructions and the refusal of a proposed instruction that would have clarified some of the standards between the informed consent and the negligence claims. I'd first like to talk about instruction number 39, which deals with agency. The first part of that instruction correctly set forth the principle that the actions of Dr. O'Brien would be imputed to Sioux Valley Clinic, his employer, under agency principles. But we objected to the second part of the sentence that states, "However, if you find Dr. O'Brien the agent is not liable, then you must find that Sioux Valley Clinic, the principal, is not liable. And we believe that that was legally inaccurate because it required the jury to find in favor of the clinic on the informed consent claim, even if the jury determined that the clinic's other employees, such as the nurses, other than Dr. O'Brien, were responsible for the failure to obtain informed consent.
But isn't the doctor ultimately responsible for obtaining that informed consent?
I think a doctor is responsible. I don't think there's anything in South Dakota law that says a hospital or a clinic may also not be responsible when, particularly when, some of the duties in obtaining informed consent have been delegated to that clinic's employees.
What was the evidence?
The evidence was that this responsibility for giving the booklets that contain disclosures about these types of surgeries, one of the booklets, or I think all of the information, was delegated to clinic employees, the nurses in particular, and sometimes other employees. And the evidence was that they sometimes forgot to give this information to the patient. The evidence, the factual evidence, was that the testimony of our client and his wife was that they never received the primary booklet that the defense is relying upon in claiming that there was informed consent for this loop surgery. They testified they never got that. And Laura Huntington is another patient who this happened to, who believed she was getting a Roux-en-Y, but in fact found out later after problems developed she had been given this mini loop after she went to the Mayo Clinic. She also testified that she never received this booklet and was not given to her. And so the jury could very reasonably have found that the failure to provide this booklet that they are relying on in the informed consent case was attributable to the nurses and the clinic employees.
But I didn't see any place where you actually argued to the jury that nurse A or nurse B or employee C, somebody other than the doctor, there should be liability because this person failed to do something they should have.
Well, I think that's probably true. I think the closing argument was more general than that.
So what's the prejudice if your theory, your agency theory, didn't involve some other employee? What difference does it make whether the instruction was wrong?
I think our theory did. I think the testimony at trial and the evidence at trial showed that this was a defense. The defense was the nurses gave you this stuff. And if the jury concluded that was not true based on testimony in the record, then this instruction required them to nonetheless exculpate Sioux Valley Clinic, even though its employees may have been the ones responsible for not giving this information. Ultimately, the doctor also is certainly responsible for not giving informed consent. But I think a clinic may be too. And we've cited cases in our brief that I think stand for that proposition.
But how can the employee be responsible for not giving informed consent if the jury says the doctor did give informed consent?
Well, I think the jury may have said that as the result of this instruction. I think that's the problem. They may have said, and they very reasonably could have determined based on this instruction, the doctor didn't do anything wrong because the nurses are the ones who did not give this information. And this instruction, though, says if the doctor didn't do anything wrong, we cannot find the clinic liable. And so I think this instruction presented a quandary that was prejudicial.
Was there even an instruction on nurses' standard of care?
There was not. There was not. I would suggest it's not a hold just because there was the claims were submitted against both defendants. And so the hospital's liable for its employees' negligent acts. I don't think it's a negligence. The nurses weren't negligent in not doing it, but they violated the doctrine of informed consent, and that's what caused the damage. And I think ultimately the clinic is responsible for that if its employees are contributor or have tasks delegated to them that it fails to do. And I think that was a legitimate problem with this verdict and may well have resulted, and I believe did. And
Even though the doctor was the only one that was going to do the surgery, obviously the nurses weren't going to do it. The rest of the staff weren't going to do it.
True, true. But the doctor is relying on the nurses, apparently, to provide this information.
I thought he testified he personally went through the booklet with every patient before surgery.
He did testify to that, and our clients and Laura Huntington testified in contradiction to that. The jury's entitled to resolve that dispute, but the problem is with this instruction is they can resolve the dispute in our favor and still be ordered under the instruction to find in favor of the clinic on the informed consent claim. I'd like to move to the error in judgment instruction just quickly. This court, I know, is familiar with the arguments for and against these types of instructions. But in this case, and I won't belabor the issue, but in this case, it's just important to note, I think, that in the closing argument, this was the only liability instruction specifically referred to. None of the standard of care instructions were specifically referred to, and I think that's typical with this instruction, and I think it speaks to the prejudicial and dominating effect that this instruction has in supplanting the standard of care.
But in this case, they did not admit there was an error.
That's true. Okay. Very true. Yeah, that was disputed. I would like to move to instruction number 27, too.
Before you do that,
yes.
On the error in judgment instruction, isn't this case substantially different than yesterday? Because today we have a case where the argument is there's two procedures. And as I understand the record, one of the issues the jury had to decide was whether the other procedure, the procedure that was actually performed, was medically acceptable. And so some kind of error in judgment instruction, maybe not that word error, but something along that line would be much more justified in this case than yesterday's case.
That was one of the claims that this there was testimony that the mini loop is itself not an acceptable procedure. That was one of a part of our negligent claims. And as the cases have said, there are cases that approve of an instruction that says when there are two alternative medically acceptable treatments, it's not negligence to simply choose among two responsible choices. And that instruction has been approved by several courts. I would suggest that that's not at all what this instruction said. This instruction simply said errors in judgments are not necessarily negligence. The type of instruction, this type of instruction doesn't accomplish what that type of instruction, the alternative theory instruction or alternative choices instruction, would have accomplished. And so I think the prejudice remains in this case.
But you'd concede that some kind of choice of judgment or something along that line had to be given in this case.
I wouldn't concede that instruction is necessarily appropriate because I can think the standard of care instructions take care of that. But I do concede that there were alternatives that were considered at least by the doctor. I think the fact that it's an informed consent claim, our case, kind of changes that too, because the alternative was one that our client had expressly said he did not want. On instruction number 27, that's our instruction that we proposed and that we contend was prejudicial in not giving. This court has held that the failure to give a requested instruction that properly states the law may be prejudicial error. It's not, of course, always prejudicial error, but it may be. And we think it was here. The instruction that we proposed made an important distinction between the informed consent and the negligence claims and what burdens of proof, what evidence was relevant related to each. And it said that the discussing the complications and potential risks of a particular procedure with a patient doesn't necessarily or doesn't relieve the physician of negligent acts. And discussing known complications is relevant to the informed consent claim. But discussing complications isn't relevant to the negligence claim if those complications, even though they were discussed with the patient, nonetheless resulted from the physician's negligence. These concepts are hard for lawyers and especially juries, I think, to understand. We think it was critical that they be instructed that the discussion of complications and risks didn't apply to the negligence claim. And it's not a hypothetical concern in this case because it was continually hit home with every witness, most witnesses, that leaks, the things that happened, an internal leak and infections, things that happened to Darryl Veith are known risks of bariatric surgery. And that was a concession obtained from most of the witnesses.
Did the judge indicate why he did not want to give that instruction?
His exact refusal eludes me at the moment. I think it was just, I don't think it's necessary. But I don't have his exact reasoning. I apologize for that. But we believe that without this instruction, the jury could have easily concluded that the defendant would be relieved of liability if these complications had been disclosed to him. We've cited cases. I think the Nielsen case from Utah is a good one that talks about the critical importance to separate when there are different theories to make sure the jury understands which instructions apply to which and which issues apply to each. And I think
we'd have to look at the whole packet of instructions to really make that decision. When you look at the whole packet of instructions, I'm assuming that, and I have not had a chance to review those entirely, but I'm assuming that that those were instructed on differently. So why wasn't that enough? If you say you can find them negligent on this, informed consent, here are the elements, you can find them negligent, you can find them liable on the negligence issue. Why isn't that enough?
I think you'll find there really is not a clear separation. If you look at the jury instruction as a whole, it's not like here are the informed consent instructions and here are the negligence instructions. I think there's some intermingling. I agree, jury instructions are viewed as a whole, and if they accurately state the law as a whole, then there's typically not prejudice. But I think here, based on the cases we've cited that talk about the critical difference of making sure when you have two types of confusing claims, like informed consent and negligence, that this type of instruction, if it accurately states the law, it should be given. And I think it prejudices us here in not giving it because of the confusion between these issues. And if you look at the closing arguments, look at the cross-examinations of the witnesses, these issues were confused. And a jury needs guidance, I think, in this type of area. I do want to get to the Schoon versus Luby type issues. The first one is the violation of a motion in limine, we believe for strategic purposes. In this case, as in Schoon, the defendants obtained an order in limine that prohibited any mention of other lawsuits against Dr. O'Brien. And there are other lawsuits alleging this exact type of thing that happened to bariatric patients. Darryl Veith's not unique in alleging that he requested a Roux en Y, believed he was getting a Roux en Y, and found out years later, or much later, that they got a mini loop after problems developed. Laura Huntington.
2 minutes.
Laura Huntington was called to testify, and the plaintiffs honored the order in limine, not mentioning other lawsuits. And that order in limine was never lifted. And then when the defendants got up to cross-examine her, they pounced on her with this issue, saying, well, you have your own lawsuit, and plaintiff's counsel represents you. And that really had the effect of decimating the credibility of Huntington and plaintiff's counsel, I believe.
Why isn't that proper cross-examination? That's unique to her.
It is entirely proper cross-examination in the absence of an order in limine prohibiting that exact questioning. And the order in limine was sought by the defendants. The plaintiffs honored it. If the plaintiffs hadn't sought that order in limine, we would have brought that out, of course, in the direct. But instead, it looked like we were trying to hide it, when in fact what we're doing is honoring the judge's order. And so I think that decimated the credibility of the witness and of the plaintiff, and I think it justifies reversal even more than in the Schoon case. If I quickly just get to the closing argument, the court can review the closing arguments for itself. I have tremendous respect for defense counsel, but sometimes the heat of a trial, the emotions are high. Sometimes these types of arguments take over, and I think what this argument was a sustained, a closing argument, not an analysis of the evidence, but really a sustained personal denigration of our plaintiff's expert witness.
But you only made one objection.
That's true. One objection, the objection was not ruled upon. Essentially, the judge said the jury can decide for itself if the arguments match the evidence. And so it was kind of, it seemed like a free rein was given. Only one objection was made, that's true. In Schoon, this court noted that a motion for a new trial can help to preserve that type of objection, and we did make a motion for a new trial on this ground.
Your time has expired, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. Going to the first issue that's been raised, the agency instruction, that somehow the nurse was delegated the duty of to obtain informed consent. This entire claim is based upon the testimony that the nurse hands the plaintiff a brochure that was prepared by Dr. O'Brien to explain his procedure and the differences between his procedure and the Roux-en-Y procedure. You've got to remember there are a lot of reasons why you would want Dr. O'Brien's mini-loop procedure. It's laparoscopic. You go in with small incisions. You aren't laid way open. And so all of his testimony that he never wanted a laparoscopic, you must remember that the nurse, Dr. O'Brien, others, he had documents in writing explaining the mini-loop gastric bypass. He received a letter that was sent to the insurance company that came into evidence being redacted that described it as the mini-loop bypass is what he was getting. But all of this, all the nurse's involvement was to hand the brochure. That is not a delegation of the responsibility of informed consent. And I respectfully suggest that under South Dakota law and under the law of most states, that's a non-delegable duty. The physician is licensed to practice medicine. The physician makes the diagnosis. The physician is going to perform the surgery. You cannot delegate that duty to a nurse. That would be error to delegate the duty to obtain informed consent because that is the practice of medicine, and physicians are licensed to practice medicine, not nurses. So this whole issue comes about of a nurse giving this pamphlet to the patient. The nurse was clearly instructed that, or the jury was clearly instructed that under the law, informed consent belongs to only Dr. O'Brien. There was no mention of it belonging to anybody else. There was no mention of a delegated duty, no instructions on delegated duty. That was not even an issue at trial. Nobody ever tried to suggest that Dr. O'Brien somehow delegated this duty to a nurse. They simply said, we didn't get the brochure. But Dr. O'Brien, the only importance of that is Dr. O'Brien says, I use the brochure when I sit down and explain the procedure to the patient. And if they don't have one, I would say, get one so that I can sit down and explain it to them. So I don't view this as much of an issue at all. And specifically, the jury found that plaintiff received informed consent in their specific answer to special interrogatories. The cases cited by plaintiff, one was under Kentucky law, where state law by statute imposes a duty for informed consent on the hospital. And the other two cases are experimental surgery cases where FDA protocols and regulations impose a duty on the hospital because it's an experimental procedure to obtain the patient's informed consent. Those are the only cases they find that impose a duty on anyone other than the physician for informed consent. Moving on, the error in judgment. That instruction has long been approved in medical malpractice cases. We know that back in the 80s it was modified to take out bona fide or good faith error in judgment. It's been approved recently by Minnesota and by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. I would note, because this is not in the briefs of any party, that in preparing for today I did find there's an ALR annotation that talks about all of the cases, and it's a good resource that sets out the law and the split of authority among the states. And that's at 6, ALR 6, 311. And I would say that the error in judgment instruction in some form is still approved in the vast majority of states.
Isn't that the issue, though? In some form? Is this the form that...
Well, I think, yeah, you can say that there's a better form, and that ALR is good because it talks about you know, you could say that when there's alternative forms of treatment available and one is chosen and it's accepted and by a reasonable number of people in the medical establishment, that that's not negligence. And it kind of combines all of that and talks about different forms and different formats. So you're right. But, I mean, this has withstood the test of time, not only in South Dakota but throughout the United States. And, you know, this case presents a perfect example of where it was appropriate. Dr. O'Brien was competent, qualified, and performs the open Roux-en-Y that requires a much larger surgical incision and a much more invasive, much more extensive procedure. He also performs, and was at the time the only one performing the procedure in South Dakota, the laparoscopic mini-loop procedure that was much less extensive, got you up, moving, out of the hospital, hopefully, in only a few days compared to over a week stay. So there's a choice between two procedures, and there's alternatives.
How does it apply, though, to the informed consent?
Well, I think it applies to the informed consent that Dr. O'Brien has a duty to advise his patient of the risks, benefits, alternatives. That's included under informed consent, alternative forms of treatment.
But, I mean, there's a standard of care, and then we have error in judgment. How would the error in judgment instruction apply to informed consent? How do you make an error in judgment about informed consent?
Well, I think that the second sentence says that, you know, if you're negligent in making an error in judgment because of the failure to perform the other duties of the instruction, whether to follow the standard of care or failure to follow the informed consent instructions, that therefore you're still liable. That's the second sentence that says, you know, that you are not relieved of your duties if you make an error in judgment if you violate either the standard of care or the instructions relating to informed consent. The one thing that, you know, obviously informed consent, if you're in a case that doesn't involve treatment alternatives like this one, or whether to perform a C-section or take a pregnant woman to vaginal birth, or whether to place plates and screws for somebody that has back surgery versus plates or something else, all of those alternatives, it's not as simple. In this case, case 3 weeks ago with Mr. Parsons' law firm, the questions are asked of all the jurors in voir dire. You know, can you hold a physician liable for running a red light? That's all this case is about, just running a red light. If you and I run a red light, we're liable. The physician ran a red light in this case. I think the instruction is important to tell the jury that this is more than running a red light. And in the case 3 weeks ago, bless his heart, out of the 19 prospective jurors, one raises their hand and says, you know, he says, I don't know much about medicine, but I sense there's probably more to this than just running a red light. We even have exceptions in our instructions to running a red light. If it's legally impossible to stop or whatever, we explain that. I think that this is a fair instruction, or one similar to it, to explain to a jury that practicing medicine is not that simple as running a red light, which was the argument used in this case and is used in most medical cases.
Let me ask you about that a little bit.
Yes.
You know, the thing that bothers me is the word error, because we're talking about ordinary jury people here that are going to make a decision, and they're told that in this one sentence, I understand there's a second sentence, but in this sentence they're told, you're not going to be liable if there's an error, and then in judgment. And how is a juror going to ever really be able to parse these legal distinctions and say, well, if I'm told he's not liable for an error, how can he be liable?
I can't relate to medicine as well as I can to law. If somebody sues me and says, you should have asked for a jury trial because you tried the case to the court and you lost, and you knew you shouldn't have tried that case to the court, and I say that was a matter of my judgment. I made a judgment. I decided not to ask for a jury trial. And the other side says, I'm sorry, you committed malpractice. That wasn't it was an error in my judgment. Am I guilty of malpractice because I decided to try the case to the court? Think of the number of times that lawyers exercise judgment. I'm more comfortable in trying to explain it in that analysis. But I can only guess the multitudes of judgments that the medical profession has to make. This instruction has been around in one form or another since long before I started practicing law. Was put in the South Dakota pattern jury instructions with the bona fide language back in the 1960s. It's been used throughout the country for that time. If this court wants to modify it, that's fine, but there needs to be something to tell a jury that when there's alternative forms of treatment and a physician selects one form, and in hindsight, because of a bad result, that turns out that there might have been better forms or better alternatives or better methods of treatment, that the physician cannot be held liable because he made a decision.
Why isn't that covered with your standard of care instruction?
Because I don't believe that the standard of care instruction even comes close to covering alternative methods or forms of treatment. If there's evidence that there's two appropriate choices, this case is a perfect example.
But that comes in through evidence, through your experts on what's the standard of care, and if there are two choices and either one meets the standard of care, you're covered. I mean, it's an evidentiary issue, isn't it, rather than a legal issue? Because if this is legally required, then you're going to have to give it. Then we're saying it's error not to give it as well.
Well, it's legally required if there's alternative forms of treatment, and in this case there were. And in this case, their witness said that there's only one form of treatment. It's the open Roux-en-Y. Anybody that does this procedure, anybody, any doctor in the country that does this procedure is guilty of malpractice. That's what he said. Wouldn't recognize that there were alternatives.
Isn't that argument to the jury, though? I mean, you're well qualified to handle that task.
Well, I don't know whether I'm qualified or not, but I think that if there are recognized alternative forms of treatment, and there are, and there were in this case, a witness should not be able to get up there and say that without having some cautionary instruction given. I mean, the instruction that you're talking about, alternatives, is not anything new. It's been around in one form or another, and if you look at that ALR decision, it will tell you and explain the situations where it's appropriate. And again, we aren't talking about a mechanical mistake where someone injures an organ or an artery or something during surgery that they didn't intend. We're talking about when there are recognized alternatives.
Is that how you argued the case when counsel mentioned that you brought up the instruction?
I said two sentences. Quote, instruction 26, a physician is not necessarily negligent because he errs in judgment. Again, this isn't like driving down the road and coming to a stoplight or obeying the speed limit. Medicine is not that easy, period. That's what I said to answer their red light exam. All we have here is a doctor that ran the red light. Practicing medicine, practicing law, it's not that simple. The transition.
Talk about this motion in limine again.
Yes.
It seems like we've seen that a few times up here, where people have come in and they sought a motion in limine, and then they, on either side, ignore it when it gets to trial.
Certainly wasn't ignored in this case, Your Honor. There was a motion in limine made. It was granted. The plaintiff then, during trial, says we're calling Gloria Huntington, her close friend, represented by the same law firm.
Did she testify, or were there any questions of her on whether she had a lawsuit?
Yes.
Cross-examination? But before cross-examination?
Before cross-examination, what happened is they called her. I went up to the bench, and I said, Judge, we object. Number one, it's prior bad acts. Number two, it's impeachment on a collateral matter. And we object to her being called to testify. And the judge said, and I said, if she does testify, I'm going to ask her if she doesn't have a lawsuit against Dr. O'Brien alleging the exact same thing, represented by the exact same lawyers, and that she's a close personal friend of the plaintiff. Judge Teedy said, Mr. Johnson, you're opening the door if you do that, and he can do that. Then Judge Teedy said, I want to hear what she's going to say outside the presence of the jury. So we heard her testimony outside the presence of the jury, and when we got finished, plaintiff's counsel said, if we wanted to withdraw our motion in limine, that's fine with him. They concede that it's proper cross-examination. It goes to bias. It goes to her credibility. They concede. Their only argument.
So did you withdraw it then? Did you withdraw that?
I didn't formally withdraw it, no, because Judge Teedy had already given me the go-ahead at the bench conference, which unfortunately isn't down. But two things about this. Number one, what they wanted me to do, I mean, I could have withdrawn it after she testified on direct. What they're asking for is a preview of my cross-examination. What are you going to ask her so that we can cover it ahead of time? When you talk about games, That's what they're asking for, is Mr. Evans should have told us that he was going to get into that so we could have covered it on direct examination. There's no law that requires that or motion in limine that requires that, that I have to forecast and tell him my cross-examination. And they admit, as I say, that it's relevant. And finally, the second point I want to make is use your common sense. If I really, after a bench conference, when we talked about this and Laura Huntington's testimony and how it was going to happen, and then we had a hearing outside the presence of the jury and talked about it, if I would have violated some order in limine, somebody would have said something. Judge Teedy would have said something. They would have said something. And I simply wouldn't have done it in the first place. But even if through some senior moment I forgot about it, certainly somebody would have brought it up. Finally, you must remember a motion in limine is not a definitive ruling. It's a preliminary ruling. And all it says is before you get into this, you must approach the bench. And that's exactly what I did. Their transitional instruction, I'm only going to mention because it was adequately covered repeatedly. And even in the special jury verdict, they had to separate the two claims between informed consent and violation of the standard of care. And 29 and 30 set out the issues, the issue instructions. You know, you need to find this by a preponderance of the evidence and whatever. There was no confusion here in the transitional instruction trying to further separate the standard of care and the informed consent simply was not error in any way and certainly not prejudicial error. Closing argument. This court stated in Wiest versus McKinnon, when Justice Meyer Henry was on the trial bench at that time, counsel is afforded the widest latitude and greatest freedom in the content of closing argument. May properly argue all legitimate inferences from such facts. And I would suggest to you that if you look at that closing argument, it's very similar to Wiest. The issue before this court in Wiest was defense counsel's questioning the credibility of the plaintiff's expert based on the fact that he was a hired gun, traveled around the country, and testified in numerous cases against physicians. In this case, the closing argument was confined to the evidence. They say that I focused on his motivation for testifying and his character, is their objection in their brief. That's fair comment. Motivation for testifying, they're instructed in instructions 13 and 14 to look at the motivation or the reasons for testifying. And his character, well, if you look in my thesaurus under credibility, testing the credibility of the witness, which they're told to do under the jury instructions, character is a synonym in my thesaurus. There was evidence. He testified against physicians in 26 states. He'd been testifying since he started practicing over 20 years ago. He reviewed over 30 cases a year. He got $10,000 a case to review. All of that was admitted, and it was a fair inference to argue that he was a hired gun. I wish I could take credit for closing arguments like that. It comes from Irving Younger in his speech that he gave to a CLE at the Eighth Circuit convention, annual convention. He said he hadn't decided what he would charge and was going to decide later. I'm accused of saying he had a contingent fee. You know, I didn't say contingent fee. I said he hadn't decided what he was going to charge. Maybe it would decide on the outcome. And quite frankly, that's not unusual. You can ask their law firm. When they lose, they go to the experts, say we lost. Don't impose a financial hardship on us or my client. Can we work out a fee arrangement and get a discount? And if we win, then we charge the full boat. It's not contingent to the extent that he gets a percentage, and I never argued that. But he said he hadn't made up his mind what he was going to charge. It's a fair inference that it might depend upon the result. Lastly, as Justice Meyer Henry noted, there was no objection to his testifying in 26 states, testifying against other doctors as long as he practiced, compensation for what he was charging, and comments about that have gun will travel, my analogy to that. No objections to any of that. And the fact that I said he'd been in the courtroom more than me, you know,
it's not unusual for young lawyers to say to a witness, take it easy on me, this is my first time in the courtroom. I mean, it's an offhanded comment. I've seen lawyers that are 40 years old that still do that. You have more experience in this courtroom than I do. Get up in closing and say the defense lawyer or the plaintiff's lawyer has a lot more experience. Don't hold that against me. It's just a comment that's made in passing, and it's not uncommon. In summary, plaintiff received a fair trial. Plaintiff lost, but he was represented by very competent counsel. Both sides were well represented. The transcript reveals that the plaintiffs received more discretionary evidentiary rulings than the defendant. It wasn't one-sided. I respectfully suggest that there's no error, certainly no prejudicial error. The real complaint is that the plaintiff didn't find in their favor. And I appreciate and I understand that. The jury argument that they make in their factual portion of their brief, I was always taught to be fair to this court and set out the facts in the light most favorable to the other side, even though it hurts to do, but you should do that. Their factual statement here in this court, as well as in the brief, is nothing more than an jury argument, I'd suggest.
Thank
the,
you, Mr.
The judgment Harris. Should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I will stand on every sentence in that brief, supported by the record fully. On the agency issue, the agency instruction, the separate claims argument, and I've explained our argument there, but the idea that there is a that there are separate claims against a clinic and a doctor is well established in South Dakota law.
What is left of that argument if the jury did find that the doctor did do the proper explanation?
Well, what the jury found was that they found in favor of the defendant on the informed consent claim.
And so what's left?
Well, they could have found in favor of the defendant on the informed consent claim because of the jury instruction that required them to find in favor of the clinic even if its clinic employees were responsible for
But to find for the doctor, you have to find he did give the informed consent. Does the clinic have to do it on top of that separately?
The clinic does if its delegation was responsible for the client or for the patient not receiving informed consent. Now, they found in favor of the defendants on the informed consent claim, but I think they could have done so based on that instruction. That's our argument in this case.
But again, if the jury found there was informed consent, what difference does it make who it came from?
Well,
if the patient was fully informed of the risks, alternatives, et cetera, what difference does it make?
But I don't think they necessarily did find. They found in favor, they found that the informed consent claim, they found in favor of the defendants. But there was not a special interrogatory.
About the doctor.
About the doctor.
Okay.
So you're saying they found for the defendant, the doctor, based on a fiction that even though the nurses may not have done it, they gave the doctor the benefit of the doubt and then absolved the clinic.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. On the error in judgment instruction, it's true. There was a claim that alternatives were presented, and the alternative that was presented or that was taken by the doctor was itself did not meet the standard of care. And that was a claim in this case, and so this may be a case in which the alternative instruction, procedure instruction does not exist in the state of South Dakota, but if it did, might be applicable. The error in judgment instruction, I would suggest, is never applicable and did prejudice the plaintiffs in this case because the standard of care was not, those instructions were not even discussed in closing argument.
This procedure, it constituted malpractice.
That was one of our claims of negligence, our primary claim of negligence.
So an error in judgment isn't really applicable to anything.
Like doesn't that. Apply to that. Our primary claim was that the internal leak that decimated Mr. Veith was never diagnosed until it was too late to be repaired. That was our primary negligence claim. On the closing argument, if you read the transcript carefully, it is really not about an analysis of Dr. Bolero's opinions at all. It is an analysis of him. And when we allow trials to become about something other than the case, other than the evidence, I think, as this court said in Schoon, it's detrimental to the administration of justice. We respectfully suggest, based on all the issues, didn't get to talk about all of them, but all the issues in our brief, we suggest that independently and collectively that a fair trial was denied in this case. We're asking for a remand and a new trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's go back to the damage to the esophagus.
Yes.
Was there evidence that that would not have occurred had they used the other surgical procedure?
I believe so. I can't point to evidence directly on that. The evidence was that the surgery itself that was done, according to our experts, that resulted in the leak, which was undiagnosed. I guess we didn't prove the negative that it would not have happened.
Did the damage then come by the instrument that you performed the surgery with?
Not the instrument, but it occurred during the surgery. I mean,
how?
The surgeon, in repairing it, did not repair it correctly as it was reattaching the esophagus or reattaching the digestive system. That ripped apart and leaked. And that's something that happens with this type of surgery.
But not with the other type?
Leaks happen with both types of surgeries.
Okay.
Leaks are much more common, I think, with the mini loop, and that was one of our contentions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons.